How can we believe in the resurrection? First thing I want to say is that it's the only way we can make sense of history. Excuse me. Think of Christianity in three parts. Part one of Christianity is this. Jesus had a following. That following believed that Jesus was the Messiah. The Jewish conception of a Messiah was that someone would come to be a new king of Israel, like David of old. And he would overthrow the Romans and he would give them their freedom. And that he would rule and make Israel great again. That was what they were expecting. And then, the man whom they had been following as the Messiah died on a cross. And that should have been the end of a movement. It undermined everything they believed about what Jesus was going to do. So that's part one of Christianity, all right? We'll skip part two for a second. Part three is this. Very shortly after the death of Jesus, you get the absolute eruption of Christianity. Jewish people, known for their utter commitment to the oneness of God, are worshipping now a crucified human being as God himself, and they are giving their lives rather than deny that. Pliny the Younger was governor at the time in northwest Turkey. He says, I ask them if they are Christian, and if they say they are, I repeat the question a second and a third time, and I warn them of the punishment if they continue to say that they are. And when they continue to say that they are Christians, I have no choice but to lead them away to execution. Okay, that was the governor at the time in northwest Turkey, Pliny the Younger. All these Christians had to do was say, all right, okay, I'm not a Christian. And then they could have gone back to their homes and continued to worship him in private. But they were so convinced that they had seen this man Jesus after he had clearly been killed, and they had spent time with them, that they were willing to give their lives for this. Now the question, that's part three of Christianity. Now the question is, what bridges the gap between part one and part three? Between the history of Christianity part one, which should have been the movement-ending death of Jesus, and the history of Christianity part three, the absolute eruption of Christianity, hundreds of people claiming to have seen Jesus after he'd clearly died, and this movement spreading so fast, so quickly, that it becomes the religion of the Roman Empire within 3 centuries. Just extraordinary. What accounts for it? What accounts for people willing to give their lives rather than deny that they'd seen Jesus alive and well after his death on the cross? Well, for a Christian, what fills that gap between part one and part three is, of course, the resurrection. The second thing that must be said is that this, for how we can believe in the resurrection, the second thing is that this is eyewitness testimony. I'm going to deal with some objections in a few moments, but this is eyewitness testimony, and I'm sure when we were reading John chapter 20, you couldn't have missed the amount of eyewitness detail in this. It's actually funny, it's so down to earth. Some of the details that John includes, I think, highlight just how real this is. I mean, even look how John calls himself the one Jesus loved. Verse 2. He does it about 5 times in the gospel, which is, I find, a little bit random, isn't it? Imagine the other disciples reading this for the first time. And they're thinking, John, I think he loved all of us. You know, did you have to describe yourself as the one Jesus loved? Really? You didn't want to say that about all of us? Okay. And then we have John here talking about beating Peter to the tomb as they ran in verse 4. And again, you're thinking, why did John include that little detail? It's quite random, isn't it? My guess is that Peter was not overly pleased with John deciding to put that in. I mean, why? it seems completely unnecessary and random detail, except that John maybe wanted to make sure that Peter would never forget. Imagine Peter reading this for the very first time. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. John, you're putting that in? Really? I never knew it was a race. I seem to recall you had a head start. Imagine Peter keeps on reading. Okay, verse 5. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then, verse 6, Simon Peter, who was behind him. Yeah, okay, John, I think you've said already that you were first. Very good. So, yes, verse 6. I went into the tomb, I saw the strips of linen lying there, verse 7, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head, verse 8, finally the other disciple who had reached the tomb first, really, John, you had to say it a third time? It was not even a race. I have no idea why John includes these little random details, but I love that he does. I love the down-to-earth, somewhat quirky nature of an eyewitness account. You just get someone telling it from their perspective as it was, and for some reason John wanted to say it three times and he got there first. It's real. He clearly remembers the run, he remembers the linen, he remembers the cloth that had been around Jesus' head, all folded up neatly by itself. And he'll never forget how he saw and believed, verse 8, when he went inside that tomb. He can testify with his own eyes that the tomb was empty, and he can testify with his own eyes the resurrection appearances of Jesus to his disciples from verse 19 and following. And take a look as well at how John sums up each little section here. Okay, I've mentioned verse 8 already. He who reached the tomb first went inside, and what does it say? We read that he saw and believed. Skip on to verse 18. Mary goes to the disciples and said, I have seen the Lord. In the next wee section, verse 20, Jesus showed the disciples his hands and his side, and John writes, they were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. And then the final section, verse 25, the disciples tell Jesus, they tell Thomas, we have seen the Lord. And Thomas replies, unless I see the nail marks in his hands, I will not believe. I have to see it for myself. And so verse 27, Jesus appeared to Thomas, it was a week later, and he said, put your finger here, see my hands. Stop doubting and believe. For John, it very, very much matters what people saw, what he saw, and what other people saw. And, you know, when Mary looked into the tomb in verse 12, we're not just told that there were two angels. We're told that there was one sitting over here, and there was one sitting over there, one where the head of Jesus had been, and one where the feet of Jesus had been. It's very specific. This is what she reported seeing. And note the honesty of her account. You know, if she had made this up, her report would have been, I don't know, I turned around and there he was. I was so amazed and overjoyed. But no, she's like, I've got to be honest, I thought it was the gardener at first. Verse 15. And you would think that it was the gardener. I mean, after seeing a man put to death, you're not expecting to hear his voice. It all adds credibility to this being an eyewitness account. So how do we account for this testimony if it never actually happened? Assuming they were not all hallucinating, what are the alternative theories? How do people try to debunk the resurrection? Some say the disciples stole the body. In fact, this was said at the time. There was a Roman guard placed at the tomb, and so the empty tomb caused some serious embarrassment to the Roman authorities. Like, how on earth would the disciples overpower a Roman guard? Matthew tells us that the chief priests bribed the soldiers to say that they had all fallen asleep, and that while they were asleep, the disciples stole the body. That's right. They had all the soldiers had dozed off, And none of them woke when the massive stone was rolled away. And yet they were able to tell, of course, what had happened while they were asleep. That was never going to be terribly convincing, was it? Evidently the guards were lying, and yet what else could they say? They have an empty tomb. What are they going to say? Maybe the main response to the idea, though, that the disciples stole the body is to point out that while people might enjoy a hoax for a while, no one dies for long, do they? I mean, scholars reckon that 11 out of the 12 of Jesus' disciples were martyred for their faith. And of course, so many other followers of Jesus were martyred too, as my quotation of Pliny the Younger bears witness to. So the question is, what would be in it for them? If they were lying, what was their motivation? We all know that many fanatical extremists might die for their faith. We've seen that. But that's because they believe it to be true. They would never do it if they knew it was a lie. I mean, it's not like being a leader in the early church was a particularly glamorous or attractive position to be in. Even those who were not imprisoned or killed for their claims, they still had to endure family ridicule and loss of jobs and many other forms of persecution. What was in it for them? Would you be prepared to suffer and even die for a lie? There's no way. Don't kill me, I made it up. The resurrection never took place, it was a hoax. Let me go now. That's what I would have said. And bear in mind as well that these were people who believed in God and that God would be their judge. They knew very well that it was blasphemous to claim that Jesus was God if in fact he was not. They knew that. So why do it if they knew it was false? Chuck Colson was special counsel to President Nixon from 1969 to 73. He did time in prison for his involvement in the Watergate scandal, but he converted to Christianity. And he said this about the resurrection. He said, I know it's a fact. Watergate proved it to me. How so? Because, he said, 12 men testified they had seen Jesus raised from the dead. Then they proclaimed that truth for 40 years, never once denying it. Every one of them was beaten, tortured, stoned, and put in prison. They would not have endured that if it were not true. Because I know Watergate embroiled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they could not keep alive for 3 weeks. You're telling me the 12 apostles could keep alive for 40 years? Absolutely impossible, says Colson. The disciples, we can also see in this chapter, were of no mind to steal the body. When Jesus was arrested, they fled, they were crushed, it was over. They weren't exactly in the mood for bravado. It says here in chapter 20 that they were hiding in a room with the doors locked because they were scared. Okay, so, well, maybe he never died. He never died. That must be it. He was crucified all right, no doubt about that, but he must have merely lapsed into a coma. He was so weak, so apparently lifeless, that he was actually taken for dead without actually being dead. And later, in the cool of the tomb, he somehow came round, despite his ordeal, and he somehow did a Houdini and wriggled out of yards and yards of smothering, confining grave clothes. And he then somehow rolled away the stone that would have weighed several tons. And then he somehow overpowered the armed guard that we read about in Matthew's account. And then he managed to appear to his disciples looking like he was not half dead, but actually fighting fit. The absurd implausibility of all that is only part of the problem with this theory. It is further undermined by the fact that when it came to killing people, the Romans were experts. They believed he was dead. The watching crowd believed he was dead. The governor Pilate believed he was dead. Joseph of Arimathea, who buried Jesus, end of chapter 19 here, he believed Jesus was dead. You don't bury people unless you're really sure. And the woman who watched him die and then watched his burial, they clearly believed that he was dead. Well, okay, maybe they got the wrong tomb. That must be it. They just got the wrong tomb. You know what some people might say about women and directions and I would never say that. I would never go there. Some people might. There's a lot I could say about this theory of, that the woman went to the wrong tomb. There's a lot I could say about that if there was more time. But suffice to say right now that if it was the wrong tomb, there was one easy way for the authorities to deal with all the resurrection chat. All the Romans had to do was, that's the tomb. That's the, over there, you got the wrong one. There it is. There's the body. There we go. Okay, well, maybe the whole story is made up. That, you know, it's just, the whole thing's a fabrication. Well, the thing is, the first accounts of the empty tomb and the eyewitnesses are written far, far too early to be fabrications. I mean, they're written within living memory. These are not written hundreds of years after the events that are told. These are written with people who were alive at the time, still alive at the time. It's still in living memory. You know, go and talk to these eyewitnesses. You know, that you could have done that if you were reading this for the very first time. You cannot get away with total fabrications if you're writing about recent, verifiable public events that loads of people present actually remember. You know, just check it, just go and ask. You can't make up something this outlandish, which is so public and so in the public domain. You can't say all these things this early. It would have been knocked out of the park. Also, there's simply no way that the eyewitness accounts, you know, if they were made up, they would never have had women as the first eyewitnesses. That just never would have happened. In their culture at that time, a woman's testimony was not even admissible in court. So there would have been no advantage whatsoever in fact, it would have been a clear disadvantage to make up that the first eyewitnesses were women. Like, the only reason in reporting that women were the first eyewitnesses, the only possible reason for saying that would be that it was true. And another huge point to bear in mind is that Christians were proclaiming the resurrection from the very beginning. And if the tomb was not actually empty, then obviously no one in Jerusalem is going to believe the preaching for one second. I mean, all anyone had to do was bring out the rotted corpse of Jesus, but they didn't. Because they couldn't, because the tomb was empty. And, you know, there's Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 saying that Jesus appeared even to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom, Paul says, are still alive at the time he was writing, which was about AD 55. The preaching of the resurrection was from the very, very start. And it just went so rapidly, and the story was so compelling that this Christian faith grew and grew and grew. How do you get from the history of Christianity part 1 to the history of Christianity part 3, apart from the resurrection? John is writing this gospel so that we have evidence to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing we may have life in his name, verse 31 here in this chapter. And certainly Thomas would not have believed without evidence. And you need evidence. And I need evidence, as Thomas did. Poor Thomas gets a bad press, doesn't he? Going down in history as Doubting Thomas. But you have to respect him. And note that his skepticism does not result in any divine judgment. Jesus actually turned up through locked doors and gives to Thomas all the evidence that he needs. And of course he needs it. Like, he's already feeling gullible for having followed Jesus for 3 years. He's not going to be taken in a second time without seeing for himself. But Thomas, as we read in verse 26 and following, was given all the evidence he needed. And his story actually becomes part of the evidence for us. And John records it so that we too would have all the evidence we need. So that we can say with Thomas, "My Lord and my God," verse 28. "My Lord and my God." Not just Jesus, you are God, but Jesus, you are my God. Clearly, believing is receiving. It's coming to Jesus and saying, "Lord, come into my life. take over my life, forgive my sin, lead me in your ways, because I want you and I need you, and I'm trusting you alone to be my savior from sin and death and hell. That's what it means to receive Jesus. That's what it means, therefore, to believe in his name. And as we were learning about on Friday night, Jesus is all our righteousness. And apart from him, we are completely lost. We have no righteousness of our own with which to stand before the Father. But because he died and because he rose again, he can say, as he said to the disciples, peace be with you. He says it 3 times in this chapter, peace be with you. That peace can be yours today. That new life, eternal life, can be yours today simply by turning to Jesus and putting your hope in him as your only savior from sin and death and hell. You want to leave this building today knowing those words are words spoken to you. Peace be with you. You don't want to walk out of here thinking, yeah, I'm really not sure about any of that. John writes, so that we have evidence, so that we can believe, so that we have life in his name. May we turn to him and know the life that he alone can give.